The Democracy Project, A History, A Crisis, A Movement, by David Graeber. Chapter 2, Why Did It Work? None of us was prepared for what happened next. It was surprising enough that the police did not immediately evict the occupiers. We expected the most likely scenario was for hundreds of riot cops, backed up by horses and copters, to be unleashed against us that very night. This would certainly be in keeping with the style of the NYPD, whose usual strategy is to overwhelm protesters with sheer force of numbers. Yet in this case, someone made the decision to hold back. One reason was the ambiguity of the legal situation. While public parks closed by 12 p.m., Zuccotti Park was a public-private hybrid owned by an investment firm, Brookfield Office Properties. Technically, such privately owned public properties are accessible to the public 24 hours a day. Still, by our experience, the mere existence of such a law would have been of little relevance if the authorities decided they wanted to evict us anyway. But it allowed something of a fig leaf. But why did they even want a fig leaf? At first, the police strategy was, instead, one of constant petty harassment to make conditions so unpleasant we would eventually leave. No tents became no tarps, power was cut off, generators were appropriated, all forms of amplification were declared illegal, but mysterious construction projects involving jackhammers began all around us. While no one was arrested for sleeping in the park, protesters were made aware that they could be arrested for almost anything else. On the very first day, when a small group marched to a nearby branch of Bank of America to chant slogans outside, two were arrested for having bandanas around their necks, on the basis of an obscure 18th century masking law originally created to control Irish highwaymen in colonial New York. The fact that none of the protesters were actually wearing their bandanas as masks, and the arrest was clearly illegal, was irrelevant, or, depending on how you look at it, the entire point. The next day, police upped the ante by arresting two occupiers for writing slogans with chalk on the sidewalk. When onlookers pointed out that in New York it is not illegal to write with chalk on the sidewalk, the arresting officer remarked, "Yeah, I know." The park continued to host thousands during the day, and hundreds remained at night. A community began to emerge, with a library and kitchen and free medical clinic, live-stream video teams, arts and entertainment committees, sanitation squads, and so on. Before long, there were 32 different working groups, ranging from an alternative currency group to a Spanish-language caucus. General assemblies were held at 3 p.m. every day. Even more remarkably, other camps began springing up across America. They, too, created general assemblies and tried to implement the hand signals and other means of operating by consensus-based, direct democracy. Within a week or two, there were at least 100, and within a month, purportedly 600 different occupations. Occupy Portland, Occupy Tuscaloosa, Occupy Phoenix, Occupy Cincinnati, Occupy Montreal. Footnote: it's hard to know how much to credit the 600 figure. I think it's accurate, technically, but a number of the smaller occupations probably consisted of just one or two people. Continuing. The occupiers were not only studiously nonviolent, at first their tactics, other than the encampment itself, consisted of little more than marching, though they began to expand to nonviolent civil disobedience with the famous blockade of the Brooklyn Bridge on October 2nd. Here is where the NYPD unleashed their traditional ferocity. This wasn't surprising. Nonviolent protesters, in New York as in most U.S. cities, even at legal but unpermitted events, can regularly expect to be physically attacked. Anyone who strayed off the sidewalk, for example, could not only expect to be arrested, but, typically, slammed against the nearest vehicle or have their heads repeatedly smacked against the concrete. Batons were used freely on unresisting marchers. All of this is standard fare, and most of us protest veterans saw nothing particularly unremarkable about it. What was unprecedented in this case was that in the mainstream media, at first largely the cable media like MSNBC, but before long, even network news began to notice and make an issue of it. This was in part because of the camera phone videos of the police violence went viral on the internet. Before long, Tony Bologna, a police officer caught on video arbitrarily pepper spraying two young women trapped behind a barricade, then casually sauntering away, became very close to a household name. But in the past, even such a viral video would never have made it onto the evening news. As a result, our numbers grew dramatically. What's more, union support materialized. Footnote: union support was only partly due to the media attention. There had been a long courtship with an emerging alliance of more radical union activists over the course of the summer, but the union leadership had decided to sit out September 17th itself. Continuing, and rallies became larger and larger. Instead of a couple thousand people coming to Zuccotti to rally or assemble for marches during the day, the crowd swelled to the tens of thousands. Thousands across America began trying to figure out how to send in contributions and calling in an almost unimaginable wave of free pizzas. The social range of the occupiers also expanded. The crowd, which in the first few days was extremely white, soon diversified, so that within a matter of weeks we were seeing African-American retirees and Latino combat veterans marching and serving food alongside dreadlocked teenagers. There was a satellite general assembly conducted entirely in Spanish. What's more, ordinary New Yorkers, thousands of whom eventually came to visit, if only out of curiosity, were astonishingly supportive. According to one poll, not only did majorities agree with the protests, 86% supported the protesters' right to maintain the encampment. Across the country, in just about every city in America, unlikely assortments of citizens began pitching tents. Middle-aged office workers listened attentively to punk rockers on, or pagan priestesses lecturing on the subtleties of consensus and facilitation, or argued about the technical differences between civil disobedience and direct action, or the truly horizontal way to organize sanitation. In other words, for the first time in most of our living memories, a genuine grassroots movement for economic justice had emerged in America. What's more, the dream of contaminationism, of democratic contagion, was shockingly starting to work. Why? Enough time has passed, I think, that we can begin to piece together some of the answers. Question 1. Why was the U.S. media coverage of OWS so different from virtually all previous coverage of the left-wing protest movement since the 1960s? There's been a lot of discussion about why the national media treated Occupy so differently from protest movements of the past, really, almost any since the 1960s. Much attention has been paid to social media, or perhaps a felt need for balance to compensate for the inordinate attention paid to relatively small numbers of Tea Partiers in the immediate years before. No doubt all these were factors, but then again, the media's initial portrayal of the Occupy protests was as airily dismissive as their portrait of what they dubbed the anti-globalization movement in 1999. A collection of confused kids with no clear conception of what they were fighting for. The New York Times, the self-proclaimed paper of historical record, wrote absolutely nothing about the occupation for the first 5 days. On the 6th, they published an editorial disguised as a news story in the Metropolitan section titled "Gunning for Wall Street with Faulty Aim." Footnote: indeed, as I have noted elsewhere, it would be almost impossible for them to do so since American journalists define the word violence as the unauthorized use of force. Gandhi, I might add, succeeded in part because he had an old-school friend who had become a prominent British journalist. Continuing, by staff writer Dania Belafonte, mocking the movement as mere pantomime of progressivism with no discernible purpose. Still, the media's eventual decision to take the protests seriously was pivotal. The rise of Occupy Wall Street marked, for perhaps the first time since the Civil Rights Movement in the 1950s, a success for Gandhian tactics in America, a model that depends on a certain degree of sympathy from the media. Gandhian nonviolence is meant to create a stark moral contrast. It strips bare the inherent violence of a political order by showing that, even when faced by a band of nonviolent idealists, the forces of order will not hesitate to resort to pure physical brutality to defend the status quo. Obviously, this contrast can only be drawn if word gets out about what's happening, which has in the past rendered Gandhian tactics almost completely ineffective in the United States. Since the 1960s, the American mainstream media has refused to tell the story of any protest in a way that might imply that American police, acting under orders, engaged in violence, no matter what they do. One flagrant example was the treatment of tree sitters and their allies protecting old-growth forests in the 1990s in the Pacific Northwest. Activists attempted a campaign of classic Gandhian nonviolence by sitting in trees and daring developers to cut them down and locking down, that is, chaining themselves together or to bulldozers or other equipment in ways that made them extremely difficult to remove, but at the same time left arms and legs incapacitated. When one tree sitter was killed and local police refused to order a murder investigation, activists locked down to blockade the scene to prevent evidence being destroyed. Police reacted by taking cotton swabs and rubbing cayenne pepper concentrate, otherwise known as pepper spray, directly in their eyeballs in amounts calculated to cause maximum physical pain. Apparently, however, the torture and murder of pacifists was not enough to convince most of the American media that the police behavior was necessarily inappropriate, and local courts declared the application of pepper spray to eyeballs an acceptable tactic. Without coverage or legal recourse, the contradictions that Gandhian tactics are meant to bring out in the open were simply lost. The activists were tortured and killed without furthering Gandhi's aim of quickening the conscience of the public in any meaningful sense. In Gandhian terms, then, the protests failed. The next year, other activists planned a campaign of lockdowns to blockade the WTO meetings in Seattle, and veterans of forest defense campaigns warned them, correctly as it turned out, the police would simply attack and torture those in lockdown, all with an approving media looking on. And indeed, this was precisely what happened. Many of the forest activists, in turn, played a key role in creating the famous Black Bloc that, after the predicted attacks had begun, struck back by a calculated campaign of smashing corporate windows, an act the media then used to justify the police attacks on nonviolent activists with batons, tear gas, plastic bullets, and pepper spray that had begun the day before. Yet, as Black Bloc participants were quick to point out, they would have justified it anyway. Breaking some windows didn't hurt anyone, but it did succeed in putting the issue on the map. This was the kind of history we were facing even before the wake of 9/11, when police assaults on nonviolent protesters became far more systematic and intense, as in the case of the New School occupation and other events. Nonetheless, in our planning assemblies for Occupy, we decided to take a Gandhian approach, and somehow, this time it worked. The conventional story is that the rise of social media made the difference. While activists at Seattle had made extensive use of web-based guerrilla reporting, by 2011, the omnipresence of phone cameras, Twitter accounts, Facebook, and YouTube ensured such images could spread instantly to millions. The images of Tony Bologna casually blasting two young women behind a barricade with a chemical weapon appeared almost instantly on screens across the nation. The most popular of the many camera phone uploads you can find on the internet has well over 1 million views. I would hardly deny social media was important here, but it still doesn't explain why the mainstream media did not play its usual role of presenting only the official police point of view. Here, I think the international context is crucial. Another effect of the internet is that in media terms, the United States is not nearly as much of an island as it once was. From the very beginning, international coverage of the protests was very different from American coverage. In the international press, There were no attempts to ignore, dismiss, or demonize the protesters. In the English-speaking world, The Guardian in England, for example, began producing detailed stories on the background and aspirations of the occupiers almost from day one. Reporters from Al Jazeera, the satellite TV news network based in Qatar that played an instrumental role in the Arab Spring by airing videos and other testimony of state violence provided by grassroots activists through social media, quickly appeared on site to play the same role in New York as it had in Cairo and Damascus. This led to wire stories in newspapers almost everywhere except America. These in turn not only helped inspire a wave of similar occupations as far away as Bahia and KwaZulu-Natal, but sympathy protests in such unlikely places as China, organized by left-wing populist groups opposed to the Chinese Communist Party's embrace of Wall Street-friendly policies at home, who had learned of the events by monitoring foreign news services on the web. On the very same day as the blockade of the Brooklyn Bridge on October 2nd, ODBS received a message signed by 50 Chinese intellectuals and activists. The eruption of the Wall Street Revolution in the heart of the world's financial empire shows that 99% of the world's people remain exploited and oppressed, regardless of whether they are from developed or developing countries. People throughout the world see their wealth being plundered and their rights being taken away. Economic polarization is now a common threat to all of us. The conflict between popular and elite rule is also found in all countries. Now, however, the popular democratic revolution meets repression not just from its own ruling class, but also from the world elite that is formed throughout globalization. The Wall Street Revolution has met with repression from U.S. police, but also suffers from a media blackout organized by the Chinese elite. The embers of revolt are scattered amongst us all, waiting to burn with the slightest breeze. The great era of popular democracy, set to change history, has arrived again. The only plausible explanation for this kind of enthusiasm is that dissident Chinese intellectuals, like most people in the world, saw what happened in Zuccotti Park as part of a wave of resistance sweeping the planet. Clearly, the global financial apparatus and the whole system of power on which it was built had been tottering since its near collapse in 2007. Everyone had been waiting for the popular backlash. Were the uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt the beginning, or were those strictly local or regional affairs? Then they began to spread. When the wave hit the very heart of the world's financial empire, no one could deny that something epochal was happening. Footnote: I remember a Taiwanese woman around 2000 who recalled her reaction to watching the protests against the WTO in Seattle the year before. I had always assumed there would be decent people in America who tried to fight what their country was doing to the rest of the world. I knew they had to exist, but I never actually seen them. Continuing. Now, this convergence between social media and international excitement explains why the U.S. media bubble could be momentarily popped, but it isn't sufficient in itself to explain why it actually was popped, why CNN, for instance, eventually began treating the occupation as a major news story. The U.S. media, after all, has a notorious history of concluding that North American phenomena that nearly everyone else in the world considers significant are of no interest to American audiences. This is particularly true of figures on the left. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a household name in France, but relatively unknown in the United States. Or even more strikingly, Noam Chomsky's political works are reviewed in mainstream newspapers and magazines in almost every country in the world except America. 20 years ago, one suspects it is exactly what the media would have concluded, that no one in America would care. I think when the future history of OWS is told, the media attention it garnered will be shown to owe much to the almost unprecedented attention so recently given to the right-wing populace of the Tea Party. The media's massive coverage of the Tea Party probably created some feeling that there should be a minimal gesture in the way of balance. Another factor in the media coverage was the existence of a few pockets of genuinely left-of-center media like MSNBC that were willing to latch on to OWS insofar as they thought the movement might morph into something along the lines of a left-wing Tea Party, that is, a political group that accepted funding, ran candidates, and pursued a legislative agenda. This at least would explain why, the moment it became fully clear that the movement was not about to go that route, media attention halted almost as abruptly as it had begun. Still, none of this explains why, even before the mainstream media picked up the story, the movement spread so quickly inside America, including to places where Al Jazeera isn't even available. Question 2. Why did the movement spread so quickly across America? When she wasn't helping with logistics and organizing facilitation trainings, Marissa Holmes spent much of her time during the early days of the occupation video recording one-on-one interviews with fellow campers. Over and over, she heard the same story. I did everything I was supposed to. I worked hard, studied hard, got into college. Now I'm unemployed with no prospects and $20,000 to $50,000 in debt. Some of these campers were from solidly middle-class families. More seemed children of relatively modest backgrounds who had worked their way into college by talent and determination, but whose lives were now in hock to the very financial industries that had trashed the world economy and found themselves entering a job market almost entirely bereft of jobs. Stories like this struck a chord with me, since I had been spending much of that summer giving lectures on the history of debt. I tried to keep my life as an author apart from my life as an activist, but I found it increasingly difficult, since every time I'd give a talk with an appreciable number of young people in attendance, at least one or two who had approached me afterward to ask about the prospects of creating a movement over the issue of student loans. One of the themes of my work on debt was that its power lies in intense moral feelings it invokes, against the lenders, and more to the point, against the indebted themselves. The feelings of shame, disgrace, and violent indignation from being told, effectively, that one is the loser in a game no one forced one to play. Of course, anyone who does not wish to spend the rest of their life as a dishwasher or sales clerk, in other words, in a job with no sorts of benefits, knowing one's life could be destroyed by a single unforeseen illness, has been led to believe that they have no choice but to pursue higher education in America, which means one effectively begins one's life as a debtor. And to begin one's life as a debtor is to be treated as if one already lost. Some of the stories I heard during my tour were extraordinary. I particularly remember a grave young woman who approached me after a reading at a radical bookstore to tell me that, though of modest origins, she had managed to work her way into a PhD in Renaissance literature at an Ivy League college. The result? She was $80,000 in debt, with no immediate prospects of anything but adjunct work, which couldn't possibly cover her rent, let alone her monthly payments. So you know what I ended up doing, she asked me? I'm an escort. It's pretty much the only way to get enough cash to be able to have any hope of getting out of this. And don't get me wrong, I don't regret the years I spent in graduate school for a moment, but you have to admit it's a little bit ironic. Yes, I said, not to mention a remarkable waste of human resources. Perhaps the image stuck to me because of my personal history. I often think I represent the last generation of working-class Americans who had any sort of realistic shot at joining the academic elite through sheer hard work and intellectual attainment. And even in my case, it turns out to have been temporary. Partly because the woman's story brought home the degree to which debt is not only hardship, but degradation. After all, we all know what sort of people frequent expensive escorts in New York City. There was, right after 2008, a moment where it looked like Wall Street spending on cocaine and sexual services was going to have to be retrenched somewhat, but after the bailouts, like spending on expensive cars and jewelry, it appears to have rapidly shot up again. This woman was basically reduced to a situation where the only way she could pay her loans was to work fulfilling the sexual fantasies of the very people who loaned her the money. And those banks, her family's tax dollars, had just bailed out. What's more, her case was just an unusually dramatic example of a nationwide trend. For debt-strapped women in college, and remember, a growing majority of those seeking higher education in America today are women, selling one's body has become a growing, last, desperate expedient to those who see no other way to finish their degree. the manager of one website that specializes in matching sugar daddies with those seeking help with student loans or school fees, estimates he already has 280,000 college students registered. And very few of these are aspiring professors. Most aspire to little more than a modest career in health, education, or social services. It was stories like that I had in the back of my mind when I wrote a piece for The Guardian about why the Occupy movement had spread so quickly. The piece was meant to be part descriptive, part predictive. We are watching the beginnings of the defiant self-assertion of a new generation of Americans, a generation who are looking forward to finishing their education with no jobs, no future, but still saddled with enormous and unforgivable debt. Most, I found, were of working class or otherwise modest backgrounds, kids who did exactly what they were told they should, studied, got into college, and are now just being punished for it. Not just being punished for it, but humiliated, faced with the life of being treated as deadbeats, moral reprobates. Is it really surprising they would like to have a word with the financial magnates who stole their future? Just as in Europe, we are seeing the results of colossal social failure. The occupiers are the very sort of people, brimming with ideas, whose energies a healthy society would be marshaling to improve life for everyone. Instead, they are using it to envision ways to bring the whole system down. The movement has diversified far beyond students and recent graduates, but I think for many in the movement, the concern with debt and a stolen future remains a core motivation for their involvement. It's telling to contrast the Occupy movement in this way with the Tea Party, which is so often compared. Demographically, the Tea Party is at its core a movement of the middle-aged and well-established. According to one poll in 2010, 78% of the Tea Partiers were over the age of 35, and about half of those over 55. This helps explain why Tea Partiers and occupiers generally take a diametrically opposite view of debt. True, both groups objected in principle to government bailouts of the big banks, but in the case of the Tea Partiers, this is largely rhetoric. The Tea Party's real origins go back to a viral video of CSNBC reporter Rick Santelli speaking from the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange on February 19, 2009, decrying rumors that the government might soon provide assistance to indebted homeowners. "Do we really want to subsidize the losers' mortgages?" Santelli asked, adding, "This is America. How many of you people want to pay for your neighbor's mortgage that has an extra bathroom and can't pay their bills?" In other words, the Tea Party originated as a group of people who at least imagined themselves as creditors. Occupy, in contrast, was and remains at its core a forward-looking youth movement, a group of forward-looking people who have stopped dead in their tracks. They played according to the rules and watched the financial class completely fail to play by the rules, destroy the world economy through fraudulent speculation, get rescued by prompt and massive government intervention, and, as a result, wield even greater power and be treated with even greater honor than before, while they are relegated to a life of apparently permanent humiliation. As a result, they were willing to embrace positions more radical than anything seen on a mass scale in America for generations, an explicit appeal to class politics, a complete reconstruction of the existing political system, a call, for many at least, not just to reform capitalism, but to begin dismantling it entirely. That a revolutionary movement emerged from such a situation is hardly new. For centuries now, revolutionary coalitions have always tended to consist of a kind of alliance between children of the professional classes who reject their parents' values and talented children of the popular classes who manage to win themselves a bourgeois education, only to discover that acquiring a bourgeois education does not actually mean one gets to be a member of the bourgeoisie. You see, the pattern repeated over and over in country after country. Chu Enla meets Mao Zedong, or Che Guevara meets Fidel Castro. U.S. counterinsurgency experts have long known the surest harbinger of a revolutionary ferment in any country is the growth of a population of unemployed and impoverished college graduates. That is, young people bursting with energy, with plenty of time on their hands, every reason to be angry, and access to the entire history of radical thought. in the United States, you can add to these volatile elements the depredations of the student loan system, which ensures such budding revolutionaries cannot fail to identify banks as their primary enemy, or to understand the role of the federal government, which maintains the student loan program, and ensures that their loans will be held over their heads forever, even in the event of bankruptcy, and maintaining the bank system ultimate control over every aspect of their future lives. As N+1's Malcolm Harris, who writes frequently on generational politics in America, puts it, "Today, student debt is an exceptionally punishing kind to have. Not only is it inescapable through bankruptcy, but student loans have no expiration date, and collectors can garnish wages, social security payments, and even unemployment benefits. When a borrower defaults and the guarantee agency collects from the federal government, the agency gets a cut of whatever it's able to recover from then on, even though they have already been compensated for the losses, giving agencies a financial incentive to dog former students to the grave." It's also not surprising that when the Great Recession that we're still struggling through struck in 2008, young people were its most dramatic victims. In fact, this generation's prospects were, in historical terms, uniquely bleak even before the economy collapsed. The generation of Americans born in the late 1970s is the first in U.S. history to face the prospect of living standards lower than their parents. By 2006, this generation was worse off than their parents at a similar age in almost every register. They received lower wages and less benefits, were more indebted, and are far more likely to be either unemployed or in jail. Those who entered the workforce on finishing high school could expect to find themselves lower-paying jobs than their parents found, and ones that are far less likely to provide benefits. In 1989, almost 63.4% of high school graduates got jobs that provided health care. Now, 20 years later, the number is 33.7%. Those that entered the workforce after finishing college or university found themselves with better jobs back when there were jobs, but since the cost of higher education has been growing at a rate that outstrips any other commodity in U.S. history, larger and larger portions of this generation have been graduating with crippling levels of debt. In 1993, less than half of those who left college left indebted. Now, the proportion is over two-thirds, basically, all but the very most financially elite. The immediate effect of this was to destroy much of what was valuable in the college experience itself, which had once been the only 4 years of genuine freedom in an American's life, a time to not only pursue truth, beauty, and understanding as values in themselves, but to experiment with different possibilities of life and existence. Now, all of this was relentlessly subordinated to the logic of the market. Where once universities held themselves out as embodiments of the ancient ideal that the true purpose of wealth is to afford one the means and leisure to pursue knowledge and understanding of the world, now the only justification for knowledge was held to be to facilitate the pursuit of wealth. Those who insisted on treating college as anything but a calculated investment, those who, like my friend at the Radical Bookstore, had the temerity to wish to contribute to our understanding of the sensibilities of English Renaissance poetry, despite an uncertain job market, were likely to do so at a terrible personal cost. So the initial explanation for the spread of the movement is straightforward enough. A population of young people with a good deal of time and every reason to be angry, and among whom the most creative, idealistic, and energetic tended to have reason to be angriest of all. Yet, this was just the initial core. To become a movement, it had to appeal to a much larger section of the population, and again, very quickly, this began to happen. Here, too, we witness something extraordinary. Beyond students, the constituencies that rallied the most quickly were, above all, working class. This might not seem that surprising considering the movement's own emphasis on economic inequality, but in fact it is. Historically, those who have successfully appealed to class populism in the United States have done so largely from the right and have focused on professors more than plutocrats. In the weeks just before the occupation, the blogosphere had been full of contemptuous dismissals of appeals for educational debt relief as the whining of a pampered elitist. And it's certainly true that historically, the plight of the indebted college graduate would hardly be the sort of issue that would speak directly to the hearts of, say, members of New York City's transit workers' union. But this time it clearly did. Not only were the TWU's leaders some of the earliest and most enthusiastic endorsers of the occupation, with avid support from rank and file, they actually ended up suing the New York Police Department for commandeering their buses to conduct the mass arrest of OWS activists blocking the Brooklyn Bridge. Footnote, I should note here that there are other factors at play. The TWU is historically an African-American union, and anti-intellectual populism is, in the United States, an almost exclusively white phenomenon, in no way shared by people of color or organizations representing them. But many unions with a largely white membership supported OWS too. Continuing. This leads to the third key question. Question 3. Why would a protest by educated but indebted youth strike such a chord across working-class America in a way that it almost certainly would have not in 1967 or even 1990? Some of it, perhaps, lies in the fact that the lines between students and workers have somewhat blurred. Most students turn to paid employment at least at some point in their college careers. Furthermore, while the number of Americans entering college has grown considerably over the last 20 years, the number of graduates remains about the same. As a result, the ranks of the working poor are now increasingly filled with dropouts who couldn't afford to finish their degrees, still paying for those years they did attend, usually still dreaming of someday returning, or who still carry on as best they can, juggling part-time jobs and part-time classes. When I wrote the story in The Guardian, the discussion section was full of the usual dismissive comments. These were a bunch of pampered children living off someone else's dime. One commentator was obsessed by the fact that several of the women protesters immortalized in press photos had pink hair. This was held out as proof that they existed in a bubble of privilege, apart from real Americans. One thing clear about such commentators was that they had never spent very much time in New York. Just as styles that were in the 1960s identified with hippies, long hair, hash pipes, ripped t-shirts, became, by the 1980s, a kind of uniform for casually employed working-class youth in much of small-town America, so as much as the style of the 1980s punk movement, pink hair, tattoos, piercings, come to play the same role today for the precarious, unsteadily employed working class in America's great metropolises. One need only look around at the people preparing one's coffee, delivering one's packages, or moving one's furniture. One reason the old 1960s antipathy between hippies and hardhats has dissolved into an uneasy alliance, then, is partly because cultural barriers have been overcome, and partly because of the changing composition of the working class itself. The younger elements of which are more likely to be entangled in an increasingly exploitive and dysfunctional higher education system. But there is another, I suspect, even more critical element. This is the changing nature of capitalism itself. There has been much talk in recent years about the financialization of capitalism, or even in some versions, the financialization of everyday life. In the United States and much of Europe, this has been accompanied by deindustrialization. The U.S. economy is no longer driven by exports, but by the consumption of products largely manufactured overseas, paid for by various forms of financial manipulation. This is usually spoken of in terms of the dominance of what's called the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, real estate, in the economy. For instance, the share of total U.S. corporate profits derived from finance alone has tripled since the 1960s. There's a chart here. 1965, 13%. 1970, 15%. 1975, 18%. 1980, 17%. 1985, 16%. 1990, 26%. 1995, 28%. 2000, 30%. 2005, 38%. Even this breakdown underestimates the numbers considerably, since it only accounts nominally financial firms. In recent decades, almost all manufacturers have gone into the finance business, as this accounts for much of their profits as well. The reason the auto industry collapsed during the financial meltdown of 2008, for example, was that companies like Ford and GM had by then for years been earning almost all of their profits not from making cars, but from financing them. Even GE earned about half its profits from its financial division. So, while by 2005, 38% of total corporate profits derived from finance companies, the real number was probably more like half when you count the finance-related profits of companies whose ostensible business was non-financial. Meanwhile, only about 7 or 8% of all profits came from industry. Footnote. Technically, the number is 12.5%, but again, this counts the financial divisions of manufacturing firms as manufacturing profits and not financial profits. Continuing. When in 1953, GM Chairman Charles Irwin Wilson coined the famous phrase, "What's good for General Motors is good for America," it was taken in many quarters as the ultimate statement of corporate arrogance. In retrospect, it has become easier to see what he really meant. At the time, the auto industry generated enormous profits. The lion's share of the money that flowed into companies like GM and their executives was delivered directly to government coffers as taxes. The regular corporate tax under President Dwight Eisenhower was 52%, and the top personal tax rate that applied, for instance, to corporate executives, 91%. At the time, the bulk of government revenue was derived from corporate taxes. High corporate taxes encouraged executives to pay higher wages. Why not distribute the profits to one's workers and at least gain the competitive advantage of grateful and loyal employees if the government would otherwise take it anyway? Government used the tax revenue to build bridges, tunnels, and highways. These construction projects, in turn, not only benefited the auto industry, they created even more jobs and gave government contractors the opportunity to enrich the politicians who distributed the booty with hefty bribes and kickbacks. The result might have been ecologically catastrophic, especially in the long term, but at the same time, the relationship between corporate success, taxes, and wages seemed like a surefire engine for permanent prosperity and growth. Half a century later, we are clearly living in a different economic universe. The profits to be won from industry have shriveled. Wages and benefits have stagnated or declined. Infrastructure is crumbling. However, in the 1980s, when Congress eliminated the usury laws, opening the way to a world where U.S. courts and police served as enforcers to loans that can go as high as 300% annual interest, the sort of arrangements one could previously only make with organized crime, they also allowed almost any corporation to go into the finance business. The word "allowed" in the last sentence may strike you as strange, but it's important to understand the language we typically use to describe this period is profoundly deceptive. For instance, we usually speak of changes in legislation surrounding finance as a matter of deregulation, of the government stepping out of the way and letting corporations play the market how they like. Nothing can be further from the truth. By allowing any corporation to become part of the financial services industry, government was granting them the right to create money. This is because banks and other lenders do not, generally speaking, lend money they already have. They create money by making loans. This is the phenomenon Henry Ford was referring to when he made his famous comment that if the American people were ever to figure out how banking really works, there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning. The Federal Reserve creates money and loans it to banks that are allowed to lend $10 for every one they hold as reserves, thus, effectively, allowing them to create money. True, the financial divisions of car companies were limited to creating money that would be returned to them to buy their own cars, but the arrangement allowed them to derive hefty profits from interest, fees, and penalties, and eventually those finance-related profits dwarfed profits from the cars themselves. Footnote. unless, that is, one prefers to see these charges, as many do, as a form of hidden inflation, again, authorized by government policy. Continuing, at the same time, corporations like GM, GE, and the rest were, like the largest banks, in many cases, paying no federal taxes at all. Insofar as their profits went to the government, it was given directly to politicians in the form of bribes. Bribery has been renamed corporate lobbying to convince them to enact further legislation, often written by the companies themselves, facilitating further extractions from citizens caught in their web of credit. And since the IRS was no longer receiving any appreciable amount of revenue from corporate taxes, the government, too, was increasingly in the business of extracting its money directly from its citizens' personal incomes, or, in the case of now cash-strapped local governments, from a remarkably similar campaign of multiplying fees and penalties.